Uther Kalving stepped through the shallows, feeling for his footing in the tricky mud. He skirted the swirls of leaked ship fluid and made toward the bank where the broken back of the yacht arched over the bog. It was hard work. He felt his body try to alter itself to better handle the effort of wading through the muck, but Uther Kalving suppressed the reaction. The glyph, Nurturunau, helped him keep adaptations to a minimum. The distance just wasn't worth the price the changes would cost him. His ruff expanded, partly to support Nurturunau, and partly as his corona felt among the weeds and grass for presences. It was doubtful anything here could harm him. The Burrali had seen to that. Still, he probed the surrounding area as he waited, and caressed the empathy net of this marshy life stew. The little creatures were all around him, all the basic standard forms, sleek and spindly birds, scaled and horn-mouthed reptiloids, hairy or furry types, which scuttled among the reeds. It had long been known that there were three classic ways for oxygen-breathing animals to cover themselves. When skin cells buckled outward, it led to feathers. When they buckled inward, there was hair. When they thickened, flat and hard, the animal had scales. All three had developed here, and in a typical pattern. Feathers were ideal for avians who needed maximum insulation for minimum weight. Fur covered the warm-blooded creatures who could not afford to lose heat. Of course, that was only surface. Within, there was a nearly infinite number of ways to approach the problem of living. Each creature was unique, each world a wonderful experiment in diversity. A planet was supposed to be a great nursery and deserved protection in that role. It was a belief both Uther Kalving and his companion shared. His people and cults were enemies, not as the Gubru were to the humans on Garth, of course, but of a certain style, registered with the Institute for Civilized Warfare. There were many types of conflict, most of them dangerous and quite serious. Still, Uther Kalving liked this Thenanen, in a way. That was preferable. It was usually easier to pull a jest on someone you liked. His slick leggings shed the greasy water as he slogged up onto the mud bank. Uther Kalving checked for radiation, then stepped lightly toward the shattered yacht. Kalt watched the Timbremi disappear around the flank of the broken ship. He sat still, as he had been bid, using the paddle occasionally to stroke against the sluggish current and keep away from the oozing spills. Mucus bubbled from his breathing slits to drive out the stench. Throughout the five galaxies, the Thenanen were known as tough fighters and doughty starfarers. But it was only on a living, breathing planet that Kalt and his kind could relax. That was why their ships so resembled worlds themselves, solid and durable. A scout craft made by his people would not have been swatted from the sky as this one had, by a mere terawatt laser. The Timbremi preferred speed and maneuverability over armor, but disasters such as this one seemed to bear out the Thenanen philosophy. The crash had left them with few options. Running the Gubru blockade would have been chancy at best, and the other alternative had been hiding out with the surviving human officials. Hardly choices one lingered over. Perhaps the crash had been the best possible branching for reality to take after all. At least here there was the dirt and water, and they were amid life. Kalt looked up when Uther Kalving reappeared around the corner of the wreck, carrying a small satchel. As the Timbremi envoy slipped into the water, Uther Kalving's furry ruff was fully expanded. Kalt had learned that it was not as efficient at dissipating excess heat as the Thenanen crest. Some groups within his clan took facts like these as evidence of intrinsic feminine superiority. But Colt belonged to a faction that was more charitable in outlook. Each life form had its niche in the evolving whole, they believed. Even the wild and unpredictable wolfling humans. Even heretics. Uther Calling's corona fluffed out as he worked his way back to the boat. But it was not because he was overheated. He was crafting a special glyph. Luranu hovered under the bright sunshine. It coalesced in the field of his corona, gathered, strained forward eagerly, then catapulted over toward Colt, dancing over the big Thenanin's crest as if in delighted curiosity. The Galactic appeared oblivious. He noticed nothing, and he could not be blamed for that. After all, the glyph was nothing. Nothing real. Colt helped Uther Calling climb back aboard, grabbing his belt and pulling him into the rocky boat head first.
I recovered some extra dietary supplements and a few tools we might need,
Uther Calling said in Galactic 7 as he rolled over. Colt steadied him. The satchel broke open and bottles rolled onto the fabric bottom. Luranu still hovered above the Thenanin, awaiting the right moment. As Colt reached down to help collect the spilled items, the whirling glyph pounced. It struck the famed Thenanin obstinacy and rebounded. Colt's bluff stolidity was too tough to penetrate. Under Uther Calling's prodding, Luranu leapt again, furiously hurling itself against the leathery creature's crest at just the moment Colt picked up a bottle that was lighter than the others and handed it to Uther Calling. But the alien's obdurate skepticism sent the glyph reeling back once more. Uther Calling tried a final time as he fumbled with the bottle and put it away. But this time, Luranu simply shattered against the Thenanin's impenetrable barrier of assumptions.
Are you all right? Colt asked. Oh, fine.
Uther Calling's ruff settled down, and he exhaled in frustration. Somehow, he would have to find a way to excite Colt's curiosity.
Oh, well, he thought. I never expected it to be easy. There will be time.
Out there, ahead of them, lay several hundred kilometers of wildlands. Then the mountains of Mulun, and finally the valley of the Sindh, before they could reach Port Helena. Somewhere in that expanse, Uther Calling's secret partner waited, ready to help execute a long, involved joke on Colt.
Be patient, Uther Calling told himself. The best jests do take time.
He put the satchel under his makeshift seat and secured it with a length of twine.
Let us be off. I believe we'll find good fishing by the far bank, and those trees will make for good shelter from the midday sun.
Colt rasped assent and picked up his oar. Together they worked their way through the marsh, leaving the derelict yacht behind them to settle slowly into the Endurant mud. Chapter 44 Galactics. In orbit above the planet, the invasion force entered a new phase of operation. At the beginning, there had been the assault against a brief, surprisingly bitter, but almost pointless resistance. Then came the consolidation and plans for ritual and cleansing. All through this, the major preoccupation of the fleet had been defensive. The five galaxies were in a turmoil. Any of a score of other alliances might have also seen an opportunity in seizing Garth. Or the Terran-Timbrimi alliance, though hard beset elsewhere, might choose to counterattack here. The tactical computers calculated that the wolflings would be stupid to do so, but earthlings were so unpredictable, one could never tell. Too much had been invested in this theater already. The clan of the Guxiu Gubru could not afford a loss here. So the battle fleet had arrayed itself. Ships kept watch over the five local layers of hyperspace, over nearby transfer points, over the cometary time-drop nexi. News came of Earth's travails, of the desperation of the Timbrimi, and of the Trickster's difficulties in acquiring allies among the lethargic moderate clans. As the interval stretched, it became clear that no threat would come from those directions. But some of the other great clans were busy. Those who were quick to see advantage. Some were engaged in futile searches for the missing dolphin ship. Others used the confusion as a convenient excuse to carry through on ancient grudges. Millennia-old agreements unraveled like gas clouds before sudden supernovae. Flame licked at the ancient social fabric of the five galaxies. From the Gubru home perch came new orders. As soon as ground-based defenses were completed, the greater part of the fleet must go on to other duties. The remaining force should be more than adequate to hold Garth against any reasonable threat. The Roostmasters did accompany the order with compensations. To the suzerain of Beam and Talon they awarded a citation. To the suzerain of Propriety they promised an improved planetary library for the expedition on Garth. The new suzerain of Cost and Caution needed no compensation. The orders were victory in themselves, for they manifested caution in their essence. The chief bureaucrat won molt points, badly needed in its competition with its more experienced peers. The naval unit set forth for the nearest transfer point, confident that matters on Garth were well in beak and hand. The ground forces, however, watched the great battleships depart with slightly less certitude. Down on the planet's surface, there were portents of a minor resistance movement. The activity, as yet hardly more than a nuisance, had started among the chimpanzee population in the backcountry. As they were cousins and clients of men, their irritating and unbecoming behavior came as no surprise. The Gubru High Command took precautions. Then they turned their attention to other matters. Certain items of information had come to the attention of the Triumvirate, data taken from an enemy source, information having to do with planet Garth itself. The hint might turn out to be nothing at all, but if it were true, the possibilities were vast. In any event, these things had to be looked into. Important advantages might be at stake. In this, all three suzerains agreed completely. It was their first taste of true consensus together. A platoon of Talon soldiers kept watch over the expedition making its way into the mountains. Slender avians in battle dress swooped just over the trees. The faint whine of their flight harnesses carrying softly down the narrow canyons. One hover tank cruised ahead on point, and another guarded the convoy's rear. The scientist investigators in their floater barges rode amidst this ample protection. The vehicles headed upland on low cushions of air. Perforce, they avoided the rough, spiny ridgetops. There was no hurry, though. The rumor they chased was probably nothing at all. But the suzerains insisted that it be checked out, just in case. Their goal came into sight late in the second day. It was a flattened area at the bottom of a narrow valley. A number of buildings had burned to the ground here not too long ago. The hover tanks took positions at opposite ends of the scorched area. Then Gubru scientists and their Kwaku client assistants emerged from the barges. Standing back from the still stinking ruins, the avians chirped commands to whirring specimen robots directing the search for clues. Less fastidious than their patrons, the fluffy white quacku dove right into the wreckage, squawking excitedly as they sniffed and probed. One conclusion was clear immediately. The destruction had been deliberate. The wreckers had wanted to hide something under the smoke and ruin. Twilight came with subtropical suddenness. Soon the investigators were working uncomfortably under the glare of spotlights. At last, the team commander ordered a halt. Full-scale studies would have to wait for morning. The specialists retired into their barges for the night, chattering about what they had already discovered. There were traces, hints of things exciting and not a little disturbing. Still, there would be ample time to do the work by day. The technicians closed their barges against the darkness. Six drone watchers rose to hover in silent, mechanical diligence, spinning patiently above the vehicles. Garth turned slowly under the starry night. Faint creakings and rustles told of the busy, serious work of the nocturnal forest creatures, hunting and being hunted. The watcher drones ignored them, rotating unperturbed. The night wore on. Not long before dawn, new shapes moved through the starlit lanes underneath the trees. The smaller local beasts sought cover and listened as the newcomers crept past, slowly, warily. The watcher drones noticed these new animals, too, and measured them against their programmed criteria. Harmless, came the judgment. Once again, they did nothing. Chapter 45 Athaclena.
They're sitting ducks,
Benjamin said from his vantage point on the western hillside. Athaclena glanced up at her chim aide-de-camp. For a moment she struggled with Benjamin's metaphor. Perhaps he was referring to the enemy's avian nature?
They appear to be complacent, if that is what you mean, she said. But they have reason. The Gubru rely upon battle robots more extensively than we Timbrimi. We find them because they are expensive and overly predictable. Nevertheless, those drones can be formidable.
Benjamin nodded seriously.
I'll remember that, sir.
Still, Athaclena sensed that he was unimpressed. He had helped plan this morning's foray, coordinating with representatives of the Port Helenia resistance. Benjamin was blithely certain of its success. The town chims were to launch a pre-dawn attack in the Vale of Sind, just before action was scheduled to begin here. The official aim was to sow confusion among the enemy, and maybe do him some harm he would remember. Athaclena wasn't certain that was really possible, but she had agreed to the venture anyway. She did not want the Gubru finding out too much from the ruins of the Howlett Center. Not yet.
They've set up camp under the ruins of the old main building,
Benjamin said.
Right where we expected them to plant themselves.
Athaclena looked at the Chim's solid-state night binoculars uncomfortably.
You are certain those devices aren't detectable?
Benjamin nodded without looking up.
Yes'm. We laid instruments like these out on a hillside near a cruising gasbot, and its flight path didn't even ripple. We've narrowed down the list of materials the enemy's able to sniff. Soon...
Benjamin stiffened. Athaclena felt his sudden tension.
What is it?
The Chen crouched forward.
I see shapes moving through the trees. It must be our guys getting into position. Now we'll find out if those battle robots are programmed the way you expected.
Distracted as he was, Benjamin did not offer to share the binoculars.
So much for patron-client protocol.
Athaclena thought. Not that it mattered. She preferred to reach out with her own senses. Down below, she detected three different species of biped arranging themselves around the Gubru expedition. If Benjamin had spotted them, they certainly had to be well within range of the enemy's sensitive watch drones. And yet the robots did nothing. Seconds beat past, and the whirling drones did not fire on the shapes approaching under the trees, nor did they alert their sleeping masters. She sighed in increased hope. The machine's restraint was a crucial piece of information. The fact that they spun on silently told her volumes about what was happening, not only here on Garth, but elsewhere, beyond the flecked star field that glittered overhead. It told her something about the state of the five galaxies as a whole.
"There is still law," Athaclena thought. "The Gubru are constrained."
Like many other fanatic clans, the Gubru Alliance was not pristine in its adherence to the codes of planetary ecological management. Knowing the avians' dour paranoia, she had figured that they would program their defense robots one way if the rules were still valid, and quite another if they had fallen. If chaos had completely taken over the five galaxies, the Gubru would have programmed their machines to sterilize hundreds of acres rather than allow any risk to their feathery frames. But if the codes held, then the enemy did not yet dare break them. For those same rules might protect them if the tide of war turned against their faction. Rule 912. Where possible, non-combatants must be spared. That held for non-combatant species even more than individuals, especially on a catastrophe world such as Garth. Native forms were protected by billion-year-old tradition.
"You are trapped by your own assumptions, you vile things," she murmured in Galactic 7.
Obviously, the Gubru had programmed their machines to watch for the trappings of sapiency, factory-produced weapons, clothing, machinery, never imagining that an enemy might assail their camp naked, indistinguishable from the animals of the forest. She smiled, thinking of Robert. This part had been his idea. Gray, antelucan translucence was spreading across the sky, gradually driving out the fainter stars. To Athaclena's left, their medic, the elderly Chimmy Elaine Sue, looked at her all-metal watch. She tapped its lens significantly. Athaclena nodded, giving permission for matters to proceed. Dr. Sue cupped her mouth and uttered a high trilling sound, the call of a fialu bird. Athaclena did not hear the snapping twang of bowstrings as 30 crossbows fired. She tensed, though. If the Gubru had invested in really sophisticated drones...
"Gotcha!" Benjamin exulted. "Six little tops, all broken to bits. The robots are all down."
Athaclena breathed again. Robert was down there. Now, perhaps, she could believe that he and the others had a chance. She touched Benjamin's shoulder, and the Chim reluctantly handed over the binoculars. Someone must have noticed when the monitor screens went blank. There was a faint hum, and the upper hatch of one of the hover tanks opened. A helmeted figure peered about the quiet meadow, its beak working in alarm as it saw the wreckage of a nearby watch robot. A sudden movement rustled the branches nearby. The soldier whirled about with its laser drawn as something or someone leaped forth from one of the neighboring trees. Blue lightning blazed at the dark figure. It missed. The confused Gubru gunner couldn't track a dim shape that neither flew nor fell, but swung across the narrow clearing at the end of a long vine. Bright bolts went wide two more times, and then the soldier's chance was gone. There was a crack, as the shadowy figure wrapped its legs around the slender avian and snapped its spine. Dathaklina's triple pulse beat fast as she saw Robert's silhouette stand on the turret of the tank, over the crumpled body of the Talon soldier. He raised an arm to signal, and suddenly the clearing was filled with running forms. Chims hurried among the tanks and floaters, carrying earthenware bottles. Behind them shambled larger figures bearing bulky packs. Athaklena heard Benjamin mutter to himself in suppressed resentment. It had been her choice to include gorillas in this operation, and the decision was not popular.
35? 36?
Elaine Sue counted off the seconds. As the dawn light spread, they could see Chims clambering over the alien vehicles. This was gamble number 3. Would surprise delay the inevitable reaction long enough? Their luck ran out after 38 seconds. Sirens shrieked, first from the lead tank and then from the one in the rear.
"Look out!"
someone cried below. The furry raiders scattered for the trees as Talon soldiers tumbled out of their hover barges, firing searing blasts from their saber rifles. Chims fell screaming, batting at burning fur, or toppled silently into the undergrowth, holed from front to back. Athaklena clamped down on her corona in order not to faint under their agony. This was her first taste of full-scale war. Right now there seemed to be no joke, only suffering and pointless, hideous death. Then Talon soldiers began falling. The avians hopped about seeking targets that had disappeared into the trees and were struck down by missiles as they stood. The fighters adjusted their weapons to seek out energy sources, but there were no lasers out there to home in on, no pulse projectors, not even chemically powered pellet guns. Meanwhile, crossbow bolts whizzed like stinging gnats. One by one, the Gubru warriors jerked and fell. First one tank, then the other, began to rise on growling blasts of air. The lead vehicle turned. Its triple barrels then started blasting swaths through the forest. The tops of towering trees seemed to hang in midair for brief moments as their centers exploded, before plummeting earthward in a haze of smoke and flying wood chips. Taut vines whipped back and forth like agonized snakes, spraying their hard-won liquors in all directions. Chims screamed as they spilled from shattered branches.
"Is it worth it? Oh, can anything be worth this?"
Athaklena's corona had expanded in the emotion of the moment, and she felt a glyph start to take shape. Angrily, she rejected the unformed sense image, an answer to her question. She wanted no laughing Tim Brimmy poignancies now. She felt like weeping, human style, but did not know how. The forest was a froth with fear, and native animals fled the devastation. Some ran right over Athaklena and Benjamin, squeaking in their panicked desperation to get away. The radius of slaughter spread as the deadly vehicles opened up on everything in sight. Explosions and flame were everywhere. Then, as abruptly as it had started firing, the lead tank stopped. First one, then another barrel glowed reddish-white and shut down. Half the noise abated. The other fighting machine seemed to be suffering similar problems, but that one tried to continue firing in spite of its crackling, drooping barrels.
"Duck!"
Benjamin cried out as he pulled Athaklena down. The crew on the hillside took cover just in time as the rear tank exploded in a searing, actinic flash. Pieces of metal and shape-plast armor whistled by overhead. Athaklena blinked away the sharp afterimage. In a momentary confusion brought on by sensory overload, she wondered why Benjamin was so obsessed with earthly waterfowl.
"The other one's jammed!" somebody shouted.
Sure enough, by the time Athaklena was able to look again, it was easy to see smoke rising from the lead tank's apron. The turret emitted grinding noises, and it seemed unable to move. Mixed with a pungent odor of burning vegetation came the sharp smell of corrosion.
It worked!
Elaine Sue exulted. Then she was over the top and gone, running to tend the wounded. Benjamin and Robert had proposed using chemicals to disable a Gubru patrol. Apiclena then modified the plan to suit her own purposes. She did not want dead Gubru, as had been their policy so far. This time, she wanted live ones. There they were now, bottled up inside their vehicles, unable to move or act. Their communications antennae were melted, and anyway, by now the attacks in the Sindh had surely begun. The Gubru High Command had worries enough closer to home. Help would be sometime coming. Silence held for a moment as debris rained to the forest floor. Dust slowly settled. Then there was heard a growing chorus of high shrieks, shouts of glee unaltered since before mankind began meddling with chimpanzee genes. Apiclena heard another sound as well. A rolling, ululating cry of triumph. Robert's Tarzan call.
Good, she thought. It is good to know he lived through all that killing. Now, if only he follows the plan and stays out of sight from now on.
Chims were emerging from the toppled trees, some hurrying to help Dr. Sue with the injured. Others took up positions around the disabled machines. Benjamin was looking to the northwest, where a few stars faded before the dawn. Faint, warlike rumblings could be heard coming from that direction.
"I wonder how Fibbin and the city boys are doing at their end," he said.
For the first time, Apiclena set her corona free. Released at last, it crafted Kahunagara, the essence of indeterminacy postponed.
"It is beyond our grasp," she told him. "Here, in this place, is where we act."
With a raised hand, she signaled her hillside units forward. Chapter 46 Fibbin. Smoke rose from the valley of the Sindh. Scattered fires had broken out in wheat fields and among the orchards, injecting soot into a morning fast growing pale and dim. 100 meters high in the air, perched on the rough wooden frame of a handmade kite, Fibbin used field glasses to scan the scattered conflagrations. The fighting had not gone at all well here in the Sindh. The operation had been intended as a quick hit-and-run uprising, a way to hurt the invader. But it had turned into a rout. And now the cloud deck was dropping, as if overladen with dark smoke and the sinking of their hopes. Soon he wouldn't be able to see beyond a kilometer or so.
Fibbin!
Below and to the left, not far from the kite's blocky shadow, Galet Jones waved up at him.
Fibbin! Do you see anything of C Group? Did they get the Gubru guard post?
He shook his head exaggeratedly.
"No sign of them," he called. "But there's dust from enemy armor." "Where? How much? We'll give you more slack so you can get a better..." "No way," he shouted. "I'm coming down now." "But we need data."
He shook his head emphatically.
"There are patrols all over the place. We've got to get out of here."
Fibbin motioned to the Chims controlling his tether rope. Galet bit her lip and nodded. They started reeling him in. As the attack collapsed and their communications unraveled, Galet had only become more frantic for information. Frankly, he couldn't blame her. He, too, wanted to know what was happening. He had friends out there. But right now it might be better to think of their own skins.
"And it all started so well,"
he thought, as his craft slowly descended. The uprising had begun when Chim workers employed at Gubru construction sites set off explosives carefully emplaced over the last week. At 5 of the 8 target sites, satisfying fiery plumes had risen to meet the dawn sky. But then, the advantages of technology began to be seen. It had been mind-numbing, witnessing how quickly the automated defense systems of the enemy responded, scything through advancing teams of irregular fighters before their assaults could barely begin. To his knowledge, not a single of the more important objectives had been taken, let alone held. All told, things did not look good at all. Thibin was forced to luff the kite, spilling air as the crude glider dropped. The ground rushed up, and he gathered his legs for the impact. It came with a jarring thud. He heard one of the wooden spars break as the wing took up most of the shock.
"Well, better a spar than a bone."
Thibin grunted as he undid his harness and wrestled free of the heavy homespun fabric. A real parasail with composite struts and duracloth wings would have been an awful lot better, but they still didn't know what it was about some manufactured goods that the invader was able to home in on. So he had insisted on homemade and clumsy substitutes. The big scarred Chim named Max stood watch nearby, a captured Gubru laser rifle in one hand. He offered a hand.
"You okay, Thibin?"
"Yeah, Max, fine. Let's get this thing broken down."
His crew hurried to disassemble the kite and get it under the cover of the nearby trees. Gubru floaters and fighters had been whistling overhead ever since the ill-fated foray had begun before dawn. The kite was almost insignificant, virtually invisible to radar or infrared. Still, they had surely been pushing their luck using it in daylight like this. Galet met them at the edge of the orchard. She had been reluctant to believe in the Gubru's secret weapon, the enemy's ability to detect manufactured goods. But she had gone along part way at his insistence. The Chimney wore a half-length brown robe over shorts and a homespun tunic. She clutched a notebook and stylus to her breast. Getting her to leave behind her portable data screen had taken a major effort of persuasion. If Thibin had imagined for a moment that he saw relief on her face when he picked himself out of the wreckage, he stood corrected. She was all business now.
"What did you see? How heavy were the enemy reinforcements from Port Helena? How close did Yossi's team get to the Skynet battery?" "Good Chens and Chimmies have died this morning, but all she seems to care about is her damn data."
The space defense strong point had been one of several targets of opportunity. Until now, the few piddling ambushes in the mountains had hardly been enough to raise the enemy's notice. Thibin had insisted that the first raid would have to count big. They would never find the enemy so unprepared again. And yet, Galet had planned the operation in the Vale of Sindh around her observers, not the fighting units. To her, information was more important than any harm they might do to the enemy. And to Thibin's surprise, the general had agreed. He shook his head.
"There's a lot of smoke over in that direction, so I guess maybe Yossi accomplished something."
Thibin dusted himself off. There was a tear in his homespun overalls.
"I saw plenty of enemy reinforcements moving about. It's all up here."
He tapped his head. Galet grimaced, obviously wishing she could hear it all right now. But the plan had been to be away well before this. It was getting awfully late.
"Okay, we'll debrief you later. By now this rendezvous must be compromised." "You gotta be kidding,"
Thibin thought sarcastically. He turned.
"You guys got that thing buried yet?"
The three Chims and the kite team were kicking leaves over a low mound under the bulging roots of a fuchsap tree.
"Hold on, Thibin."
They began collecting their hunting rifles, stacked beneath another tree. Bibbin frowned.
I think we better get rid of those. They're Terran make.
Galet shook her head emphatically.
And replace them with what? If we're stuck with just our 6 or 10 captured Gubru lasers, what can we accomplish? I'm willing to attack the enemy stark naked if I have to, but not unarmed.
Her brown eyes were hot. Bibbin felt his own anger.
You're willing to attack. Why not go after the damn birds with a sharpened pencil, then? That's your favorite weapon. That's not fair. I'm taking all these notes because...
She never finished the remark. Max interrupted, shouting,
Take cover!
The sudden whistle of split air became a rocking boom as something white flashed past, nearly at treetop level. Fallen leaves whirled and floated out upon the meadow in its wake. Bibbin did not remember diving behind a knotted tree root, but he peered over it in time to see the alien craft rise and come about at the crest of the far hill, then begin its return run. He felt Galet nearby. Max was to the left, already high in the branches of another tree. The others had flattened themselves over to the right, closer to the verge of the orchard. Bibbin saw one of them raise his weapon as the scout craft approached again.
No!
he shouted, realizing he was already too late. The edge of the meadow erupted. Gobbets of earth were thrown skyward as if by angry demons. In the blink of an eye, the maelstrom ripped through the nearest trees, propelling fragments of leaves, branches, dirt, flesh and bone through the air in all directions. Galet stared at the chaos, slack-jawed. Bibbin threw himself onto her just before the rolling explosion swept past them. He felt the wake of the white fighting craft as it roared past. Surviving trees rattled and shook from the momentum of displaced air. A steady rain of debris fell onto Fibbin's back. Galet's face emerged from under his arm. She gasped.
Get friggin' off of me before I suffocate, you smelly, flea-crackin' moth-eatin'.
Bibbin saw the enemy scout plane disappear over the hill. He got up quickly.
Come on, he said, hauling her to her feet. We've got to get out of here.
Galet's colorful curses ceased abruptly as she stood up. She gasped at the sight of what the Gubru weapon had done, staring as one does at what is too horrible to believe. Bits of wood had been stirred vigorously with the grisly remains of 3 would-be warriors. The Chim's rifles lay scattered among the wreckage.
If you're planning on grabbing one of those weapons, you're on your own, sister.
Galet blinked. Then she shook her head and mouthed one word. No. She was convinced. Then she whirled.
Max!
She started toward where they had last seen her big, dour servant. But just then, there came a rumbling sound. Bibbin stopped her.
Troop transports. We haven't got time. If he's alive and can get away, he will. Let's go.
The drone of giant machines drew closer. She resisted still.
Oh, for Ifni's sake, think of saving your notes,
he urged. That struck home. Galet let him drag her along. She stumbled after him a few paces, then caught her stride. Together, they began to run.
Some girl,
Bibbin thought, as they fled under the cover of the trees.
She might be a pain in the ass, but at least she's got spunk. First time she's ever seen anything like that, and she doesn't even throw up.
Yeah? Another little voice seemed to say inside him.
And when did you ever see such a mess, either? Space battles are neat, clean, compared to this.
Bibbin admitted to himself that the biggest reason he had not puked was that he'd be damned if he'd ever let himself lose his breakfast in front of this particular chimney. He'd never give her the satisfaction. Together they splashed across a muddy stream and sought cover away from there.